You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Alexa Dadd, and today we are talking Nats baseball. We bring in our Nationals reporter for MLB.com, Jamal Collier. Jamal, finally something to talk about with the Nationals. They signed their first position player this offseason, former Cardinals and Braves first baseman Matt Adams. He's going to supply a much-needed bench role for this team. What do you believe he brings to this team, and how much do you think his production can compare to what the Nats got from Adam Lind?
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty much, you know, thinking this is going to be an exact replacement for Adam Lind. They've had the last couple of years kind of had that kind of bigger, burly, left-handed first baseman to back up Ryan Zimmerman. Clint Robinson, if you remember a couple of years ago, then it kind of filled in to Adam Lind with him. And, you know, they had a chance to bring Adam Lind back. He had a $5 million mutual option that the Nationals actually declined, in part because they said, hey, we think we can get that same kind of role, that same kind of player for cheaper out in the market. And they basically, that gamble paid off. You know, to get Matt Adams in, he's in for $4 million, so he saved about $1 million, put some incentives in there. He's a guy who, you know, has the power, obviously. He's had success as a pinch hitter, sort of a limited sample, but he has been pretty good in that role. And they think that, you know, he's a guy who's like 3 or 4 years younger than Adam Lind is as well. And probably is probably better suited to play every day. Like Adam Lind, he's a guy who you probably don't want to face a whole lot of lefties. He's just so much better against righties. Sort of around an 820 OPS against righties, against about a 600 OPS against lefties in his career. But, you know, he's a guy who they think can play the same role. Adam Lind, as you remember, hit a lot of big home runs for them, was such a huge weapon off the bench and just a huge threat when you have a guy like that kind of looming on the bench. And I think that they see him in kind of the same way they saw Lind.
How much were you surprised that Adams was willing to take a step back and not have a starter role with this team?
You know, I don't think I was that surprised, just because I saw last year the market really for those kind of his kind of player. I'm going to talk about a guy who is really just kind of a power bat that, you know, doesn't necessarily going to hit for the highest averages and necessarily going to play defense or move around him very well. But we've seen in this game the way the homers have kind of exploded so far that really teams weren't paying for that kind of player. And that's kind of why Adam Lind lingered so long last offseason. And, you know, the Nats signed him the day of the reported spring training for, I believe, a $1 or $2 million deal. It wasn't very much. And I think just with that probably in mind, seeing how that market developed last year, I think if he saw a role with the Nats where he knows he's going to be used, has a chance to win and win a World Series and a team that obviously is going to be kind of successful or competitive next year, I think that it was, you know, probably natural that he wanted to kind of jump in and get out ahead of it as opposed to waiting and lingering out for the next couple months like Lind did, and it kind of did not pay off.
So Matt Adams fills a much-needed bench role there for the Nationals, but they still have some other pieces there on the bench to address. How do you believe they'll fill those spots? What names is the organization talking about right now?
Yeah, so I mean, I think they feel pretty good. You have a guy like Adams, who's the first guy off the bench. Wilmer Defoe will probably be that backup middle infielder. They've already also have kind of envisioned him maybe getting some more experience in the outfield during spring training. But you have those guys. Brian Goodwin's a pretty good fourth outfielder. I think the two spots you're looking at is one is the backup catcher. Right now, Pedro Severino kind of slots into that. But I think that they have also kind of poked around a little bit about some of the other free agent catchers, veteran catchers on the market. You know, guys like Avila or Miguel Montero, some of those guys might make sense for them to kind of go out and try to sign. But I think that looking at a backup catcher and then you're looking at one guy potentially to replace Howie Kendrick, I think they still are open to bringing Howie Kendrick back. I think that that thing kind of works out. But he's similar in the sense that, you know, he might be able to find somewhere where he can play more of a set role, play a little bit more of a day and have some guaranteed playing time as opposed to coming to D.C. But, yeah, I think that they're really not a whole lot for them to fix right now in that bench. Probably just one more player that they'll want to definitely have. And they may do that through a combination of spring training invites and guys to come out and try out for a job once February comes around.
All right, let's talk about the bullpen. And they obviously addressed that issue midseason, bringing in Doolittle, Madsen, and Kinsler. And they reached an agreement to bring back Brandon Kinsler on a 2-year deal. He's expected to take a physical this week. It's going to become official after that. Why was it important to both sides in this deal to have him return to D.C.?
Yeah, I mean, I think just one, you saw how just much that settled things once they brought Kinsler back in their bullpen last year, when you had him, Madsen, and Doolittle as a whole. Now you're talking about this bullpen now gets a lot deeper. and you got guys like Cody Glover, Sean Kelly, who are a little bit of unknowns because of their health. Now you can protect them a little bit. You don't have to run them out as many innings. You can kind of try to ease them back in and make sure you kind of keep them healthy and such. So they feel pretty good now about their guys from the right side, especially the guys from the left, you know, Sammy Solis, Andy Romero, to go along with Doolittle. They feel pretty good about those guys, too. So I think, in general, it just makes their bullpen a lot deeper. It's kind of the right-handed pitchers they want. They really just were impressed by what Kinsler had last year, especially when you put him in a role like he was in, where he's, you know, in the seventh inning, but also if it comes down to it, they need some off days for Batson or Doolittle. He can slide in there. He's got closing experience before and has gotten big outs before. And I think that they feel comfortable kind of using him in any of those kind of back-end roles. I think for him, also, is, you know, he wanted to win. And I think that the Nats, obviously, the team, like we said, is going to have a chance to compete, not only just to win the division, but to go to the World Series again. And I think that, you know, having that kind of guaranteed, you know, sort of role where he's comfortable with, a place that he's been in before, and a chance to do it for a World Series contender seemed to be more enticing to him than going to a team where he may have had a chance to close, but maybe not had the same chance for success in the postseason. So, you know, Rizzo and the Nats believe that he had some offers on the table to be a closer or to have maybe a little bit more of a prominent role somewhere else. But I think he chose the side of winning as opposed to going for that.
Yeah, and hopefully he is able to do that with this team because, unfortunately, they haven't had too much luck in the postseason recently. Let's talk about a couple of players who are recovering from injury during Nats Winterfest this weekend. We saw Daniel Murphy hobbling around on crutches, which I don't know if it was the greatest sight for Nationals fans, but he is, you know, only a few months removed from knee surgery. The Nats say he's on track to be ready for opening day, but Murph has declined to give a timetable or at least a specific one for his return. What evidence do we have that tells us he's going to be ready for opening day, and what's their backup plan if he's not ready?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a dicey situation because, like you said, the Nats seem to be pretty confident. I think the biggest evidence, thing that I've kind of pointed to, just the way that they've kind of operated, they have not really been interested in, or not really been actively searching for any kind of backup for Murphy. Now, that part of that's because of Wilmer Defoe, and they feel pretty confident about what he brings in that role. They have to play him every day for some kind of extended period of time. We saw him when he was backing up for Trey Turner last year, but he did pretty well in that role. And I think that, one, they feel comfortable if they have to use Defoe for a week or 2 weeks or a bit a month that he can kind of fill in. But, you know, I think that they feel pretty good about Murphy. You know, this is a rare sort of surgery for a baseball player to have, but players have come back from it before, including Justin Turner, Murphy's former teammate and kind of good friend in New York. But I think that they, you know, all signs kind of point to the fact that if he can be ready, somewhere near spring training or somewhere in spring training or somewhere near the start of the season, that they're comfortable maybe missing a week or two or so with him and just to get him fully right. And he's a guy who takes care of himself and who knows his body very well, too. You know, he's not a guy who's going to necessarily come back from an injury early when he's not ready or push through things when it's not necessarily prudent for him to. And I think that it's going to be a combination of just trusting Murphy and you know, trusting Defoe as well if they do have to go with him as a backup. But it's a little bit hard to say. I mean, Murphy still seems pretty encouraged, and he didn't want to put a timetable on it just because he doesn't want to say he'll be ready by this date, and then if he's not ready by this date, everybody's kind of wondering what happened. But I think the biggest thing is you know, that the way they operate this offseason kind of still lets me believe that they think that Murphy can be back, if not right into the start of opening day, somewhere shortly after. And I think that, you know, so far, I guess we're going to believe him.
And a lot of people would tell you the philosophy of not setting a timetable is actually smart because then people can't get on you for not being there when you said you were going to be. Oh, is there a setback? Is there, you know, and that creates all sort of, you know, a mental component to coming back from an injury, too. So I thought that was kind of an interesting decision by Murph and a smart one, too. Speaking of injury rehab, Adam Eaton said he's going to be ready to go for opening day. He's obviously spending time, rehabbing from that torn ACL. Any concerns with Eaton, do you believe, not making it for opening day?
You know, Eaton thinks he can be ready to start an opening day of spring training, probably to go out there and try to play nine innings. He's just been kind of chomping at the bit here. Obviously, that injury was so long ago. We're talking about the beginning of last or end of last April, that he's kind of been sidelined. So I think with Eaton, the biggest thing with them is he's got to test it out. You know, he's obviously working his way back to potentially come back during the playoffs. He was saying he was not sure whether or not that would have been realistic or not, but he was going to keep trying. And I think that, you know, he's done a lot of things to kind of get himself ready to test out his knee and do everything except for actually play in baseball games. And I think that that's just going to be such a key hurdle. He's going to have to go and make some of those movements that you just don't have to make until you have to cut and get a ball in the gap, or you have to try to, you know, go from first to third, or try to get a, or, you know, try to extend for a triple, whatever it might be. And I think that's going to be the biggest kind of hurdle for Eaton right now. But it was far enough out removed that I think that, you know, he should be still on track and should be no worries as far as him being ready for opening day. But another guy the Nats are not going to want to necessarily throw him right into the fire here. They're going to probably try to ease him in spring training, make sure he's 100%, make sure that knee responds to everything before they're really, ready to run him out there every day. But so far, so good. Everything seems clear for Eaton. He's encouraged and kind of clearing all the hurdles that he's needed to, that we should see him back on the field when it's time to open up.
Perhaps the biggest story for the Nationals, and one of the reasons I didn't bring it up earlier was really just because it's going to be ongoing, I think, for a while, is the contract extension, possibly, or free agency of Bryce Harper. And a lot of people, when I tell them that I'm not a Nationals fan, they say, well, you know, where's Bryce Harper going to end up in 2019? And I really don't have an answer for them. I don't know anyone does, but they were talking about how they had early contract extension talk, at least between the team and Bryce Harper's agent. Anything there, or are we just still kind of a wait-and-see situation?
Definitely a wait-and-see situation. I think a couple things that I kind of read into it. One, the fact that even if they're having that conversation, even if it doesn't lead to anything this offseason necessarily, you're at least, you know, laying the groundwork and seeing exactly what kind of number, what kind of thing that Harper and Boris and company are going to be looking for in that next contract. And right now you have a year window here before the start of next offseason that you have exclusive rights to be able to, you know, negotiate with Bryce. And even if that doesn't necessarily lead to anything for this offseason, I think it's just, you know, smart in a way right now to have it where over the next 10 months or so, you're going to be able to continue to sell Bryce every day almost, or as much as you possibly can, on why this is the place that he should be spending, you know, the next however long his next contract would be. And I think that just is something that I think I took away from it, is that they're already starting that kind of process. The fact that Boris and Harper are still willing to meet and have those conversations shows that they have not closed the door on DC. You know, so people who think that Bryce has definitely got one foot out the door, I never really bought that, because he does generally seem to like DC, and he does, you know, I think wants to be open to the idea of spending one place, staying in his entire career in one place. So I think that there's a couple things to be encouraged by just on that sense. On the other hand, you know, it's looking more and more likely that this thing is going to go to free agency here next winter. And I think that then you're talking about an open up and a sort of a bidding war between the rest of the teams. And we've seen some of the things that the other teams in the league, the Yankees, the Dodgers and such, have done to kind of put themselves in position financially to really be big players next year as well. So that being said, we're pretty much in a wait and see. We don't know what Bryce is going to do in the next year. I don't know if he knows what he's going to do in the next year. And, but I think right now the Nats have the next couple of months where they are Bryce, you know, Bryce, they have this kind of relationship with Bryce and a chance to pitch him every single day if they have to, or if they want to, or as much as they possibly can, to let him know why DC would be the place that he should kind of set up for the future.
Jamal, we're heading into the holiday season. Give me one thing on the top of the Nationals' holiday wish list, and maybe that is Bryce Harper staying in the nation's capital, but I'm sure there's a laundry list of things. If there's one thing on the top of that wish list, what do you think it is for Nationals fans?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on the one hand, Nationals fans can kind of be like me as a kid. They can be a little greedy, because on the one hand, you want Bryce Harper, and extending him would be a huge thing. But I think the biggest thing for them right now is obviously winning the World Series. And getting out of the first round of the playoffs as well kind of goes with that. But the chance to advance in the playoffs, to get to the World Series, at least for the first time in this franchise's history, would be huge for this team. It's obviously the way they've operated and tried to do some things they've done this offseason to try to bring back this team, to fire a new manager who can get them over the hump. So getting over the hump and getting to the World Series, I think it's still got to be at the top of the Nationals' wish list. And they've got a chance to at least next year to have Bryce Harper right in front of that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Jamal, thank you so much. Happy holidays. Enjoy it, and we'll talk to you in the new year.
Thanks a lot. You too.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. Today, we're talking Mets baseball, and we bring in our Mets reporter, Anthony DiComo, for MLB.com. Anthony, the Mets announced they are reuniting with former GM Omar Minaya as a special assistant to Sandy Alderson. What can Minaya bring to the table in this role?
Well, from a baseball perspective, I think Omar Minaya is well regarded and has been really for decades as a talent evaluator. He came up as a scout and is a very traditional minded scout, which is something the analytics bent front office doesn't have a ton of, not a ton of people with Omar's experience. So he brings that. He brings decades of experience scouting and developing players. I think a lot of people would say he did a great job developing the Mets teams when he was GM. A lot of the players who wound up being on the pennant-winning team that went to the World Series in 2015 were guys that Omar drafted or guys that Omar signed as 16-year-old free agents out of the Dominican Republic or Venezuela, guys that came up through the system and drafted and developing. So he has a wealth of experience in that arena. Now, of course, it is an interesting hire because he's essentially now working under the person who replaced him in 2010. It wasn't all gravy for Omar Minaya when he was here the first time. There were peaks. There were also valleys, a couple of collapses in 2007 and 2008, and then a couple of fourth-place finishes in 2009 and 2010 kind of sealed his tenure at the time. So there's obviously potential for a little bit of awkwardness. It would be like going back going back to an organization that essentially fired you 7 years earlier. But I don't think anyone denies what Omar can bring to the table in terms of that scouting and development. And you look at the Mets front office now with him, with Sandy Alderson, with J.P. Ricciardi, who is a former general manager with the Blue Jays, and John Rico, who is the assistant GM and has been for a long, long time now. There is a wealth of experience in this front office. They certainly don't lack in that arena, and Omar is just another cog in that machine now.
Well, you mentioned that he's had ups and downs with the organization. I think overall, if you're looking at it from, you know, a standpoint of whether it was successful or not, at least the players who have had success there have, you know, been a result of, you know, Omar Minaya's regime, whether it was drafting or developing a lot of those players who were instrumental to this team. But why not bring in new blood? Why bring somebody back who's already been in the organization rather than somebody new?
Well, I think, you know, you have to go to the top. Omar Minaya has had a longstanding, good relationship with the Wilpon family. Certainly, they've been in contact throughout the past years. I'm not sure they ever really got out of contact. And I think he's a well-liked, gregarious guy. So given all of that, you know, as long as Sandy Alderson and the people who are sitting in those chairs up there aren't opposed to it, that would be the reason why. And the other thing is, as I mentioned, you know, the game today skews so much toward one type of evaluator, towards these highly educated guys who are very bent on analytics and see the game through that prism. And Omar Minaya is the opposite. His roots are in scouting. His roots are in traditional scouting. His roots go way back to the 1980s and, you know, really doing it at a grassroots level. So I think he brings that bit of diversity just in terms of his knowledge base that he can bring to the front office. And those are the reasons why I would say the organization is going in that direction as opposed to maybe bringing someone from completely outside the organization in and starting fresh.
All right, let's talk about the Mets' current GM, Sandy Alderson. He's given a contract extension. He's been the Mets' GM, like you mentioned, since 2010, replaced Omar Minaya. He was responsible for some big names being in Queens, guys like Noah Syndergaard, Yoenis Cespedes. Why should fans be excited that Sandy Alderson remains there to be their GM?
Well, Sandy Alderson called it unfinished business on the press release. And really, this was something that had been decided way back in September. You know, it was clear for months that Sandy Alderson was coming back. I think the question is not whether Mets fans should be excited, because I think by and large, you know, the team has had a decent amount of success under him, despite some limitations with their payrolls and other factors. I think the question is, how long is Sandy Alderson going to do it now? You know, he's 70 years old. I have an inkling that if the Mets had gone and won it all in 2015, he might have retired then and there. But they didn't, and like I said, his quote was unfinished business. So does he want to do this for one more year? Does he want to do this for two more years? Does he want to do this until the Mets make another deep run, maybe win it all? We'll see. He and the team have been very coy about what his future is. They were pretty adamant in not releasing the terms of this contract. We don't know how long it was for, and it seems to people in the organization like they may be going year to year at this point with Sandy Alderson as GM. Certainly there is a lot of work for him still to be done, but this is also the same guy who brought the Mets back all the way back to the World Series in 2015, so there's certainly optimism about what he can do. Interesting situation, and I'm curious to see how long really he is the general manager.
All right. We'll definitely continue to monitor that. Mets continue to monitor the free agent market for a first baseman who can then also play some outfield. Matt Adams signed with the Nationals, so he's obviously no longer an option. They were taking a look at Adrian Gonzalez, who is DFA'd by the Braves. What's the likelihood he plays in Queens?
I don't think it's super likely. I don't think the Mets would be looking at him if it wasn't a situation where the Dodgers and the Braves are paying pretty much all of his salary, and any team that signs him would only be on the hook for the major league minimum. So that being the case, you look at him and you say, okay, this guy's 4- or 5-time All-Star, Gold Glove winner, obviously has had a long, successful career. But you also have to look at the more recent. Adrian Gonzalez had a sub-300 on-base percentage last year. A lot of injuries, some discontent within the Dodgers clubhouse. So taking all of that in and looking at other options that are still out there, whether it's an Adam Lind or Logan Morrison, if you're the Mets, do you say, okay, we're just going to sign this guy and hope that at age 36 he can rebound and he can come back and be a productive player? I think it makes more sense to go in another direction. Now, it wouldn't shock me if the Mets go and trade for Adrian Gonzalez because they don't want to commit long-term to anyone at that position. They still have very high hopes for Dominic Smith, and they don't want to block Dominic Smith. So signing someone like Gonzalez to a major league minimum deal, if they wind up cutting bait in May, it would be no great loss. So that would be the benefit. But I'm just not sure how much upside there is left in Gonzalez's game at this point at age 36. And given all that, I'm not sure if that is the move that the Mets will ultimately make.
All right, the trade market seems to have some second basemen the Mets could target. Even though Ian Kinsler, who was on their radar, went to the Angels, there are several names out there that the Mets could swing. Who in your mind is the best fit for them?
Well, the best fit is probably, you know, I would say like a Josh Harrison of the Pirates is a name that keeps coming up. He's a guy who can not only play second base, but also some third base, also some outfield. That's the type of versatility that the Mets love. Problem is, a guy like Josh Harrison is going to be very expensive in terms of prospects, and the Mets, in addition to having kind of a low budget of money they can spend on the 2018 payroll, they don't have a lot of prospects that are desirable to other teams right now. So it would be a difficult sell for the Pirates, just as it would be difficult to get, say, a Cesar Hernandez from the Phillies. The one guy who seems a little more attainable is Jason Kipnis from the Indians, and maybe that does still unfold. Now, there's a chance that none of these unfold as the Mets. The Mets just cannot swing a trade for a second baseman. In that case, you're probably looking at Jose Reyes coming back and playing second. He has made it very clear that he wants to come back and he wants to play in New York. The Mets have sent out indications that they are okay with looking in that direction, and that's something that wouldn't really unfold until January once the Mets have exhausted their options on the trade market. But it would not surprise me one bit to see the Mets essentially no-go on all of these trades and wind up with Reyes at second base. Again, limited budget to work with this winter, so if you can get a guy who will only cost you a few million dollars as a starting position player, it's something that the Mets have to look long and hard at.
All right, as we head into the holiday season, give me one thing on the top of the Mets' holiday wish list. Maybe it's that Noah Syndergaard and Mr. Met finally repair their relationship and become best friends because we've seen some animosity between the two of them, or maybe it's getting back to the playoffs. What do you think is the one thing that's at the very, very top of their holiday wish list?
Yeah, well, it's the old chemistry in the clubhouse versus winning, and the chicken and the egg, which breeds what, right? I have a feeling if the Mets wind up going out and winning 95 games this year, that Mr. Met and Noah Syndergaard will be best friends again.
Yeah.
But look, it's all about health for this team. If the Mets could wish for one thing, it would be that this rotation of Noah Syndergaard and Jacob deGrom and Matt Harvey, really those three specifically, stay healthy for a full season. Because if they do, if you get those three guys healthy, and you could obviously throw Steven Matson into that mix and Zach Wheeler, but if this rotation and the guys at the top of it are healthy, I don't think anyone doubts that this team can compete. And if they're not, I don't think anyone doubts that this team's going to be in big, big trouble. So if you're unwrapping those presents under the tree, as Sandy Alderson and Mickey Callaway and everyone in charge with the Mets, that's what you want. You want a team that can, after years of injuries and injuries and injuries, that can stay healthy throughout 2018.
All right, sounds good. That's going to do it for MLB.com Extras, talking Mets baseball. Thank you so much, Anthony. Happy holidays, happy new year, and we'll talk to you in 2018.
Okay, Merry Christmas.
Hey everyone, welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Alexa Datt, and today we are talking Marlins baseball. We bring in Marlins reporter for MLB.com, Joe Fusaro. And Joe, big story for the Marlins this week is the fact that their CEO, Derek Jeter, held a town hall meeting with season ticket holders to address the season ticket holders' concerns about the team. What was your reaction to this town hall?
It kind of went as expected. It was lively. I mean, when you make the moves the Marlins make and you have the history of transition, down here, there's going to be a reaction. There's going to be some anger. There's going to be some passion. And all accounts are Derek Jeter kind of handled it as well as he could. Even some of the responses I'm getting back and the feedback from people that were there, or even some of the ones who don't like the moves, gave him a lot of credit for, being up there and listening and hearing their pleas. Some of it got a little crazy, but that kind of happens down here from time to time. We're kind of used to it. So, they've been through fire sales before, if we want to even use that word. And then the bottom line is, Jeter is kind of stuck to his guns, and that's going to be kind of the key throughout this whole process. Is he has said from the start there will be unpopular, there will be some unpopular decisions and some moves. But this team has not won. They haven't had a winning season since 2009, haven't been to the postseason since 2003, and changes were going to be in order. And, he talked a lot again about sustainable success and the stuff that we've kind of addressed for months, that there's not enough farm system, there's not enough pitching. And, as good as the core was, you had a couple of guys having career years, and it really wasn't a sustainable formula. So that's why I think you're seeing what you had coming. And I thought it was a good step. And the reaction from other media that was at the event was it was a good step to try to, get in front of the people, explain what you're doing, and then, lay a plan out and then follow it.
Joe, is this the only town hall that the Marlins are going to hold, or are we expecting others?
Well, they said there could be more, but, normally this isn't completely foreign for this team. I mean, I was here the first day that David Sampson and Jeffrey Loria took over and back in 2002, and they had a town hall meeting, and they did it in a town hall style at FanFest. And, there will be FanFest, I assume. We haven't had all the details yet, but that usually kind of leads into the start of spring training, either late, January, early February. So I wouldn't doubt, some more, meetings like this, whether it'll be 200, invited season ticket holders or others, time will tell. But I think there will be throughout this process kind of a feeling out from the fans' reaction that, teams, wants to gauge what is on people's minds, and then they'll act accordingly.
In terms of the players' reactions, JT Realmuto and Christian Yelich have expressed both of their displeasures recently about staying with the team after, obviously, these key pieces were traded away. Do you believe that both of these players, one or neither, will be with the team next year?
I think they both will be on the opening day lineup, whether they get moved at any point after that. But, the team has a kind of strategic plan of how they want to push this forward. And, what I heard was, after the three major trades, Gordon, Stanton, Ozuna, that was it. That's kind of where they wanted to take this at this point. There's all sorts of reasons for moves being made, and a lot of it could be service time, obviously salary. Realmuto's just entering arbitration. He's not a free agent until for 3 years. And my understanding is, he just kind of doesn't want to be the lone guy standing if everyone's moved. Yelich just lost, the Marlins, you can make a case, had the best outfield in the National League, if not baseball, in terms of productivity with Yelich, Stanton, Ozuna, and two-thirds of them have been traded. So Yelich has been up since 13. He also has not been part of a winning team. But, I think, if he's a disgruntled player, if they think that one of these two or both are going to be disgruntled in a point where it could be detrimental to the team, maybe they act accordingly there. But there's really no urgency or pressure to move either. Normally, you get that kind of reaction, from, I imagine, other teams when key players are moved. I'm sure if someone gave them a call and at the moment that happens, I'm sure you would get a lot of people saying they want to go to a winner or a team more primed to win. But bottom line is, Michael Hill sent out a statement after those reports came out saying that the Marlins will be the ones initiating the conversations with clubs when they intend to, you know, pursue training a player.
All right, let's talk about some of the newest members of the Marlins, something that fans can get excited about. They get Sandy Alcantara from the Cardinals for Marcell Ozuna. What do you believe his upside is, as he's now the top prospect in this farm system?
Oh, I think Sandy's a guy that, you know, he's someone I'm personally looking forward to seeing in spring training, electric arm. I mean, just, you know, 8 appearances with the Cardinals last year, a very small sample size. But StatCast had his fastball average at 98-plus miles an hour. So, you know, an electric arm, a guy that they envision pitching at the top of a rotation, 22 years old. And, you know, the only question is he going to show enough in spring training to be on the opening day roster? There is no urgency. I mean, if you're in a process of wanting guys to develop and pitching is certainly king, you know, or key, I should say, to making this thing improve, he's going to have to be well, you know, be ready. And so I wouldn't be surprised if Alcantara starts off, let's say, in AAA or AA and spends a couple of weeks, if not the first month, and kind of gets, you know, promoted that way. But if he pitches and shows worthy of being in the rotation from day one, you know, that could happen as well.
They also get Magnera Sierra from the Cardinals in that Ozuna deal. I just remember on his first major league hit, they were playing the Braves, and when the ball made its way back to the dugout, Carlos Martinez pretended to chuck it into the stands and then held on to it instead. And Sierra's face, you could just see like, no, like, don't let that ball go. That means so much to me. I know that Marlins fans are going to be excited once they get their eyes on this kid, because he's got a lot of upside for this team too.
Yeah, and some of the, you know, in terms of timeline to get him to the big leagues, kind of similarly to Alcantara, where you're looking at, you know, if Sierra needs another month or so, I anticipate at some point he will be the center fielder. If Yelich is still here, I think Yelich goes to left field. And in Marlins Park, which is really spacious, you need someone that can fly. And, you know, all indications are he's, you know, among the fastest players in baseball and covers a lot of ground. I hear about his hitting. He has a way of kind of having the ball hit the barrel of the bat. And not a big power guy, but, you know, would be kind of that prototypical, you know, speed defensive guy, apparently a really good arm. And, you know, as a team, you know, when you trade, you know, D. Gordon and 60 stolen bases leave there, and, you know, Sierra is a guy that could kind of hit that speed leadoff guy who can steal a couple of bases for you at the top. So whether that's April, whether that's June, whether that's next year, you know, they're all part of a process right now. So another guy that fans could be excited about, you know, to see what he can do as this moves on.
How about their pitching prospect, Jorge Guzman, who came to Miami in that Stanton deal?
That's maybe the most interesting guy they got. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of criticism that the Marlins didn't get, you know, very good return on Stanton. And, you know, time will tell on that, but all I've heard about Guzman is from people I really respect that know baseball, said the most electric arm in minor league baseball. Not the most electric arm in the Yankee system, in minor league baseball. And throws up to 103 miles an hour, you know, a really nasty slider. And it'll be very interesting. Here's a guy that will not be rushed. I don't anticipate seeing him, you know, opening day, and maybe not for the first half or maybe even all of the season, unless it's like a September type thing. But I think when you get somebody with that much raw talent and could be a legitimate ace, and you got a guy like Gary Denbo, the vice president of player development scouting, who saw him and worked with him in New York in their system, you know, this is going to be a guy, a future ace, they hope, and a lot of upside. Now, you know, power arm, we'll see how he holds up. We'll see how the command is. But the minor league numbers, the strikeout to walk ratio, really, really good. But, you know, he's going to be a guy that's going to get a lot of excitement. And, you know, this is the type of rotation that, if not a matter of months, maybe 1 year, could have three guys when you count Jose Urania that are throwing 100 miles an hour. And I don't think there's another staff like that. I know the Mets with Syndergaard and so forth. But, you know, this could be a very unique situation in Miami here if these guys all kind of click and kind of start coming into their own, what that can mean to the, you know, to getting this thing in a spot to win.
Yeah, that's what the organization is hoping for sure. As we're going into the holiday season, give me one thing on the top of the Marlins wish list, potentially heading into and then coming out of, you know, the Christmas and the New Year they could potentially do in January.
Yeah, I think, you know, from all indications, it kind of addressed something by bringing in Jacob Turner. He signed a minor league deal with an invite formerly in the Marlins system. People remember he came over in the Anibal Sanchez, Omar Infante trade in 2012 from Detroit. Now, is this a significant signing? No and yes. It addresses kind of the big picture. They are looking for veteran right-handed or veteran starters who can come in and log innings and ease, you know, the pressure of having to promote Alcantara, Guzman, and others more quickly than they should. So I'm anticipating some free agent signings or starting pitching that will, you know, be guys that could help get this thing and add the depth. Now, secondly, I think that you're going to have to at some point see, you know, probably a corner outfield type that has potential to hit up to 20 home runs because, you know, they just traded 96 home runs in Stanton and Ozuna. You're never going to recover that. That's obvious, but you're going to have to win a little different way. But still, you would like to have a little bit more power in the outfield because as of right now, let's say Sierra is on the opening roster. You have Yelich, and then you got a guy named Branston Lee who came over in the Adani Echeverria trade back in June, who might be the best defensive outfielder in minor leagues. That's how he was projected. He was the Double-A at Double-A Jacksonville. He ended up being the Southern League's batting champion and a guy who isn't getting really any credit, but he's a guy who's left-handed bat, who can hit, get on base, run, and play really plus defense. And he's an interesting guy. As of now, I'd probably have him in right field. But the thing is, you basically have Yelich to be the power bat of those three. So you probably want to see a little bit more power come from a corner outfield spot. I know they'll want, like, Dietrich to play out there, but Dietrich never hit more than, like, 12, 13 home runs. You know, it's not like he's proven to be a 20-homer guy. So I think you're going to see a push for starting pitcher that could help, you know, the young guys develop and then a power bat, somebody that could get them about 20 homers.
All right, something to look forward to for this Marlins team and their fans. That's going to do it for us here on MLB.com Extras Marlins Edition. Happy holidays, and we'll see you in the new year, Joe. Thank you so much. Hey, everyone. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Alexa Datt, and today we are talking Braves baseball. We bring in our Braves reporter for MLB.com, Mark Bowman. And, Mark, this is one of the things that we have talked about on this podcast, whether Matt Kemp was going to be moved or not. And he is. He's traded to the Dodgers in a swap of really big contracts. Lefty Scott Kazmir, right-hander Brandon McCarthy, infielder Charlie Culberson, and Adrian Gonzalez, who the Braves then DFA'd, all came to Atlanta. Braves also got some cash in that deal. Let's break this down one by one. First, they DFA'd Adrian Gonzalez. What was behind that decision?
Well, that to get Adrian to agree to the trade, the Braves had to guarantee him that he would be DFA'd immediately. There were obviously the Dodgers did not have a bats to give him, and the Braves did not have a bats to give him there at first base. This was essentially, you know, the kind of trade you'd see in the NBA a lot of times. You know, we've seen a few in baseball, but to move Matt Kemp's contract, to move Adrian Gonzalez's contract, unwanted contracts, you know, the teams had to be creative. For the Dodgers, they wanted to reduce their payroll this year to get underneath the luxury tax implications, get away from that. For the Braves, they were willing to take on salary this year, a year where they're probably, you know, even with additions, you know, if you make enough additions, you can become a playoff team. But in terms of, you know, my example was always, hey, look, if you add Clayton Kershaw to that young rotation right now, they're probably still not a playoff team. So I think they're still a year away. So you take on money right now within this trade, knowing that this is going to be another step within the rebuild, but you enter next offseason where the free agent market, everyone knows how abundant, how much talent will be on that free agent market. They're going to enter that with at least $80 million to spend and maybe closer to $100 million, depending on where their payroll goes. So they will be major players next year, a year where they will have had a chance to spend the next this upcoming summer evaluating where their young players stand, exactly what their needs are, how to best take that next step to becoming a playoff team. So, you know, I don't think Braves fans should should go, oh, well, they've already given up and they've thrown the white flag. No, what they've done is something that was wise. Instead of trying to push things for this season, live with what you have, make some changes. You know, Matt Kemp needed to go for a number of reasons. You know, the injuries piled up last year. He did come to camp in great shape, to his credit. He was productive for about 6 weeks, but as soon as the hamstring issues started bothering him and affecting his on-field play, his conditioning habits came into question. He regained all the weight that he had lost over the winter. And in some ways, you know, players, coaches, everyone was starting to see that he was not the best influence within the clubhouse. So it was, when you've got a young kid like Ronald Acuna coming, an impressionable 20-year-old mind, I think you want to create the right clubhouse culture. So to gain that financial flexibility next year is big. And also, you know, look, Brandon McCarthy and Scott Kazmir, they come with question marks. But McCarthy was healthy enough to be on the World Series roster. If he can give the Braves 140 innings, that's great. If Kazmir can at least, you know, prove that he's healthy enough that maybe they can flip him at some point this summer, then he provides some value as well. So, and to add a bench piece like Charlie Culberson, that just adds to your versatility. This was a trade that the greatest impact will be felt down the road. But at the same time, Alex Anthopoulos did, you know, take care of some of his off-season desires here to add experience to his rotation and some depth to the bench.
Charlie Culberson, it's funny, he stands out to me. You know, he broke out in a big way for the Dodgers this season, but during their playoff run, I remember him celebrating that home run while they were still down by a couple of runs, and that's kind of what the talk of the town was the next day. But either way, he seems like a long-term player for this Braves organization, someone that can make an impact in the future, right?
Yeah, you know, and he grew up not far from Atlanta, about an hour, hour and a half north, and really probably, you know, just an hour north of SunTrust Park. You know, I think he'll be a good fit. You know, everyone talks about his character. I think the one thing I'll never forget about Charlie Culberson was that home run he hit during Vin Scully's last game there at Dodger Stadium. That's one thing. I guess he'll. That's what I'll always remember Charlie about. But, yeah, just to add a guy that with that kind of versatility, from what I understand, like I said, high-character guy that can do a lot of things. If his presence allows them to think about playing, utilizing Johan Camargo as their everyday third baseman, I don't know if that's Camargo's future long-standing role. But at the same time, this is, once again, the year to find out exactly what he is as an everyday player. Let's not forget, you know, Dansby Swanson struggled last summer, and that's primary reason Dansby went back to the minors. But it was also had to do with the fact that Dansby wasn't playing because Camargo was playing so well. He's the best defensive infielder within the system. I think that you know, he has a bright future here in Atlanta. I don't know exactly what his role is. Maybe he isn't best utilized as a utility player. But if you get a chance to give him regular bats this year, that's not a problem. He can certainly handle the role and maybe keep that position warm until Austin Riley's ready. Or let's just go ahead and throw out Machado's name, since, you know, get things stirred up here a year ahead of time.
Let's do it, man. Come on. It's almost the holiday season. People are licking their chops for that kind of stuff. The Braves were looking for a veteran pitcher, we know. Is Brandon McCarthy, Scott Kazmir their answer to that, or are they still looking?
I think they're the answer, you know, or is that the guy that some Braves fans might have wanted? No, but I think that they were just looking for guys to eat innings to protect some of their young arms. And like I said, they're looking for McCarthy to do that. Anything that Kazmir gives them is gravy now. I mean, it's they basically just had to take on that contract to get all the other benefits. And, you know, he's battled injuries, you know, throughout his career, at least over the last three seasons, did not pitch at all last year at the big league level. You know, I think with McCarthy, if he can kind of produce just like R.A. Dickey did last year, just be that guy that sets a good example within the clubhouse, a guy that, you know, an experienced guy that some of the young pitchers can go to when they have problems, and somebody who just, he takes that ball every 5 days, and then at some point in the summer, you know, it would be a good problem to have. You you step back and go, okay, Mike Soroka and Colby Allard are ready for the majors. You know, we don't have a spot for them. You know, what are you going to do with Brandon McCarthy? I mean, if you get to a point where you don't have Brandon McCarthy this year, that's not a problem. That means your young kids are developing to the point that you want them to, but you don't want to get stuck early in the season and push these kids because you need a rotation spot. You want them, you want to be able to allow them to develop fully at the minor league level before you call them up. I think Sean Newcomb benefited from that last year where he was able to spend two full months at AAA before coming up. A year earlier, the Braves brought Aaron Blair up in April. And, you know, Aaron Blair now 2 years later, he comes to the majors, you know, as a celebrated prospect, and now people have completely forgotten about him. Does that mean he came up too early? No, not necessarily. But at the same time, I think you want to do whatever you can to make sure that your prospects had every opportunity to develop fully before coming to the big leagues.
Braves also acquired Preston Tucker from the Astros in exchange for some cash or a player to be named later. What can fans expect from Tucker?
Well, this is a guy with power potential. He hit 13 homers for the Astros in 2015. You know, he struggled the following year, and then as the Astros continued to evolve into World Series champions, he became a forgotten character, and that's understood. You know, he's a left-handed bat that could get some time in left field, especially at the beginning of the year. My current expectation is they'll wait, that Acuna will not be on the opening day roster. They'll probably wait a few weeks or maybe months before calling him up. So Tucker and Lane Adams, with the current structure, I think they could share some time in left field until Acuna comes. He's a guy that it's interesting. You can't teach that kind of power. You'd like to see him his contact rate increase. But at the same time, you know, it's worth taking a flyer on this guy. It doesn't cost him anything. It's a deal where a player to be named later with cash, one of those deals that maybe you'll strike gold, and then if you don't, who cares? You at least took a chance on a guy that you're bringing into your system. And like I said, you can't teach that kind of power potential. You hope at some stage a guy like this starts to increase his contact rate just enough to add a little more value to his game.
All right, Mark, we're heading into the holiday season. Give me one thing on the top of all Braves fans' holiday wish list.
I think the wish list this year should be to see at least two of these three guys. I'm going to go ahead and mention these three guys, Mike Fultonevich, Sean Newcomb, and Luis Gohara. You want to see two of those three guys make significant strides this year to give you the confidence that they're ready to enter 2019 as a legit number two or number three starter. You know, you're interested. You want to see the Sorokas, the Allards, the Freeds make progress. I'm going to be patient with them. I'm going to push these guys a little bit more just because they finished the year in the rotation and put the focus on them. If two of those three guys make significant strides over the course of this season, I think at this point next winter when you and I are talking, we'll no longer be using the word potential playoff contenders. We'll say, hey, look, this team is a legit playoff contender.
All right. Hopefully they get that wish. I've heard that word potential a lot, and sometimes it's a positive, and sometimes if it's attached to your name for too long, it's not so much. So, yeah, it'd be nice to see those guys reach that full potential and eventually make it to where they're supposed to be. All right, that's going to do us for here on MLB.com Extras Braves Edition. Mark Bowman, thank you so much for joining us. Happy holidays. Happy New Year, and we will see you in 2018.
Happy holidays to you as well. Take care.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Alexa Datt, and today we're talking a little Phillies baseball. We're bringing our Phillies reporter for MLB.com, Todd Zielecki. And, Todd, the Phillies introduced the newest member of their team, first baseman Carlos Santana, this week after signing the former Indians player to a three-year, $60 million deal. The big question, I think, on everyone's mind is, why did the Phillies make this move now?
Well, they made it for a few reasons. One is kind of the right price at the right time, and you know, $60 million is obviously a lot of money, but from what Phillies GM Matt Klintak said at the news conference this week, you know, they like the length of the deal. You know, the Phillies have a ton of money to spend. You know, they only had Odubel Herrera signed beyond next season. So they had the money. And, you know, if it had been a four-year deal, a five-year deal, a six-year deal, like Eric Hosmer could possibly get, the Phillies just weren't interested in that. So they like the idea that Carlos Santana has been a very productive player over the past seven seasons. He's going to be, you know, he could potentially become a free agent after his age 34 season. So they feel like they'll still get some prime years out of him. In other words, you know, the idea of signing him to a six-year deal where he'll be 36. And the Phillies just saw, you know, the struggles of Jimmy Rollins and Chase Utley and Ryan Howard as they got into their mid to late 30s. And I don't think they were really willing to repeat that. So it gives them some flexibility going forward. They love the fact that he's a switch hitter. They love the fact that he controls the strike zone. He walks just about as much as he strikes out. They love the fact that he can play some gold glove caliber first base. And, you know, now they can kind of team him up with Rhys Hoskins in the middle of the lineup or at the top of the lineup anyway. And suddenly that Phillies offense looks actually pretty decent going into next season.
Yeah, the fact that he has hit 20-plus home runs in five of the past seven seasons, they obviously like that consistency. They know he's a good teammate. He's a positive presence in the clubhouse. The fact that he's a veteran for these younger guys makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned Rhys Hoskins, him and Rhys Hoskins in this lineup. What is this lineup going to look like? Where do these guys fit? And how much do you actually think they can get out of Santana next year?
Well, you know, I was looking at Santana's numbers just earlier. He has 600 plus plate appearances each of the last seven seasons. So I think he's going to play pretty much every single day, either at first base, maybe occasionally in left field. That's a possibility. But in terms of the lineup, I wouldn't be surprised on opening day if you have Cesar Hernandez leading off. He's got a 372 on base percentage over the past two seasons. You know, Gabe Kapler said at the press conference that he likes the idea of Carlos Santana hitting second. He sees the number two hole as a spot for the best hitter on the team. You know, I guess traditional thinking has that, you know, being the number three hitter, maybe even the number four hitter, but he likes his best hitter on the team to hit second. So I could see Carlos Santana hitting second. I could see Odubel Herrera hitting third, and then Rhys Hoskins hitting fourth. You know, but of course you could have Rhys Hoskins hit third as well, which would give you a really dynamic 1-2 punch in the top third of that lineup. And then after that, you have, you know, Aaron Altherr, Nick Williams to kind of play somewhere in the outfield. You have Michael Franco, who the Phillies are kind of still hoping is going to turn things around. You know, you have Jorge Alfaro, Andrew Knapp, Cameron Rupp behind the plate. Not really sure how that's going to work out. And then J.P. Crawford who's been a high on-base percentage guy throughout his minor league career. So, you know, the Phillies, really since 2012, they're like 29th in baseball in on-base percentage. They haven't scored because they can't get anybody on base. And now you look at this lineup with Hoskins, Santana, Crawford, Hernandez, Andrew Knapp, and you see a team that should really be able to work some long at-bats and get on base and score some more runs.
All right, let's talk about in the field. You mentioned Carlos Santana going to be playing first base there. That moves Rhys Hoskins out to left. Do you like that move? Do you think he fits well as a corner outfielder, or is there maybe some concern here as he switches positions?
Well, it's funny, you know, some members of the Phillies coaching staff last season, you know, it was entirely new coaching staff this season. A lot of those guys actually thought that Rhys actually could be might be better defensively in left field than at first base. So I think they saw he didn't play a ton of time out there last season in left field, but it was really the first time he'd ever really played left field since like his freshman year of college. So they saw enough good things that they feel comfortable with it. Now they're not being delusional. They don't think he's going to be a gold glover or, you know, anything like that, but they think he's a guy that will hold his own, catch the balls that he can get to. You know, hey, the Phillies for years, they had Pat Burrell in left field. They had Raul Ibanez in left field. Neither of them were gold glove caliber left fielders. Neither of them, you know, were particularly fast runners. So I think they're comfortable with it. And again, that kind of goes back to the three-year deal with Santana. Worst case scenario, you know, they're not locked into it for like, oh my gosh, we have Eric Hosmer through 2023. Rhys has to play left field. If it doesn't work out for some reason, maybe they can figure something else down the road. But I think in the short term, anyway, at least that first couple of years, they're confident that he's going to be okay out there.
So with his move to left, it creates a little bit of an interesting situation with their outfield. They have Odubel Herrera, Nick Williams, Aaron Altherr. Are they moving any of these guys? Are they comfortable keeping, you know, everyone? What's the situation there?
they certainly could move one of those outfielders. You know, they're still looking for a starting pitcher, and I think they really do need a starting pitcher now after you get Santana. You know, if you're really going to try to take that step forward, I think they really need to upgrade the rotation. So it's possible that Herrera, Altair, Nick Williams could be included in a trade for a controllable starting pitcher. If not, you know, Gabe Kapler thinks that he can get enough plate appearances for everybody else to keep everybody happy. If Reese is productive and healthy, I figure he's going to play pretty much every day. So that's 600 plate appearances. Gabe thinks he can get 400, 500 plate appearances for the other three. I've kind of looked at the math. Technically it is possible, but it's highly unlikely. You know, there wasn't a team last season with four outfielders with 400 or more plate appearances. There hasn't been a team like that since 2014. Because, you know, hey, there's injuries, guys are going to struggle. You have a fifth outfielder, you're going to move some guys around every once in a while. But I think that knowing that, you know, guys are getting hurt, et cetera, guys are going to need days off because they're struggling. They should be able to get Altair and Williams and Herrera, I would say, you know, at least each 350 plate appearances. Some guys are going to get more, some guys are going to get less. But, you know, they should get enough playing time, I think, to keep them somewhat happy. Now, that remains to be seen, but that's kind of the plan as of this moment.
Two other additions to this team come from the bullpen. Pat Neshek and Tommy Hunter are both given two-year deals. What do you think these relievers are going to bring to this Phillies team?
It just gives them a lot of depth. It gives Gabe Kapler many more options. They've talked about possibly going with an eight-man bullpen if they can't get another starter. And if they do have an eight-man bullpen, now you have two productive veterans in Neshek and Hunter to go with Hector Neris, Luis Garcia, Adam Morgan, Dubry Ramos, Victor Arano. The Phillies bullpen pitched really well down the stretch. And so I think what they were trying to do is in the event they can't get starting pitching help, they're going to have such a strong bullpen that, you know, if Vince Velasquez or Jake Thompson or Zach Eflin is getting knocked around in the fourth inning, they're not like, oh, now we got to go to our mop-up guy and hope he can keep the game close. It's like, no, now it's the fourth inning, it's fifth inning. We can actually use Tommy Hunter here or Pat Neshek here or Luis Garcia here, and it's just like one stud after another to keep them in the game as long as possible. You saw this happen a lot in the postseason. You know, starting pitchers, even if they were pitching well, only going five innings and going into a rock-solid bullpen, and that's what I think the Phillies were trying to recreate with the additions of Neshek and Hunter.
The last time we had talked about the fact the Phillies had received trade offers for Freddy Galvis, and they had received offers from the Padres. He ends up going to the Padres. 28 years old, he played great defense. Do they get enough in return, do you feel like, and what does that return entail?
Yeah, Eniel De Los Santos, he's a right-handed pitcher. You know, he's ranked as the ninth best prospect in the Phillies' system, according to MLB Pipeline. You know, all things considered, I think they did okay. I had some fans on Twitter saying, oh, my gosh, I can't believe all they got was a double-A minor league pitcher for Freddy Galvis. And I guess I get that to an extent, but I also pointed out to those people that Freddy was going to be a free agent after next season. He had like a career high 694 OPS last season, which is not offensively meaning, you know, he's not a very productive offensive player. You know, defensively, I love to watch him play. I thought Freddy should have won the Gold Glove last season. But, you know, for a guy like that, again, kind of a light hitting all glove shortstop that's going to be a free agent in one season, you're not going to get a team's top prospect. You know, you're just not going to do that. So I think the Phillies did okay considering that situation. And also, quite frankly, I think they needed to move one of those infielders. I think if I'm the Phillies, I want to see what J.P. Crawford could do on a daily basis. I think J.P. Crawford's floor as an offensive player is going to be as good as possibly Freddy Galvis's ceiling as an offensive player. So I think if J.P. goes out there and really struggles this season offensively, he could still have a 350, 340 on base percentage, which is like 40 points, 50 points higher than Freddy Galvis has ever had.
Todd, this team obviously still wants to add a starting pitcher, and we've discussed in the past the possibility of them signing Jake Arrieta and Yu Darvish and how that was slim. Does that change now, do you believe, with the signing of Santana and them shoring up their bullpen, or do you still expect them to go looking for pitching with maybe a lower price tag?
I still think it's going to be a lower price tag unless they can get somebody like a Garrett Cole in a trade. I just don't see the Phillies going 6 years, $180 million for Jake Arrieta, because still, even with the move of Santana, they still have so many question marks. Like, they're hoping that they take a nice step forward this season, but to commit that much money into a pitcher with so much mileage on his arm, I really don't think it makes a lot of sense. Now, if it's late January and, you know, other teams have already moved on and filled their starting pitching needs, and Jake Arrieta is still out there, and somehow, I think it's highly unlikely, but say somehow Scott Boras comes up to the Phillies and says, hey, you know, how about 3 years, $90 million for Jake Arrieta? I can see the Phillies actually jumping on that, knowing, again, it's only a three-year commitment. So something could happen like that, maybe late, right before spring training. But otherwise, I think they're going to continue to kind of look at that mid-level market, just kind of an innings eater, some guy that can give the rotation a little bit more stability. But again, if the Phillies can work out a trade for Chris Archer, you know, maybe they go in that direction as well. You know, that's certainly an option.
Obviously, bringing in Carlos Santana and shoring up their bullpen are moves to make them look attractive for next year's free agent class, because it is a big one. If you had to pin down who you believed out of that free agent class would head to the Phillies, a lot of people saying it could be Manny Machado, Bryce Harper. Who do you think would be the best fit for this team in that free agent class, and you think would the Phillies could attract the most?
Boy, I think right now Machado makes a lot of sense. You know, if you have Rhys Hoskins in left field now, and if you think that Herrera, some sort of combination of Herrera, Altair, and Williams can be productive in the outfield, Michael Franco just hasn't shown it really at third base. Now, I know Manny Machado is kind of indicated he wants to move to shortstop after he signs as a free agent. Well, if Manny Machado wants to come to the Phillies and play shortstop, they can always move J.P. Crawford over to third base. I think that's something that could happen. But so position player wise, I think Manny certainly seems to fill a hole on this roster. You know, the Phillies don't have any big third base prospects coming up right now or are close to the big leagues. So another superstar kind of infielder on the left side of the infield to me makes a lot of sense. But I don't think the Phillies are going to be picky if they strike out a Manny Machado and they can get Bryce Harper. They'll trade one of those outfielders or two of those outfielders to make it work. I mean, there's going to be nothing that's going to prevent, or no roadblock, I don't think, that's going to prevent them from getting Manny Machado or Bryce Harper in terms of current player personnel. You know, obviously they're going to have to come up with the money to make them happy and to get them to agree to sign, but it's not going to be a situation where Altair and Williams and, you know, we can land Bryce Harper, but we don't know what we're going to do with these other outfields. No, they'll make it work if they can make the money work.
All right. Well, before we get to that, we have to get through this season first. And then, first of all, let's get through the offseason. Let's get through the holiday season for starters. What do you believe is at the top of the Phillies' holiday wish list, something that going into next year that they desire the most?
I think, other than the starting pitching, because we talked about that, I think they desire the most is incremental improvement by their young players. You know, I don't think the Phillies believe that if just small step forwards, I'm not talking about huge leaps, but if Rhys Hoskins can improve a little bit, Nick Williams, Jorge Alfaro, J.P. Crawford, just take a little bit of a step forward in terms of their production, particularly with the other young starters, Jared Eichhoff, Vince Velasquez, Nick Pivetta, Jake Thompson, you know, all those guys, if they can just take a little step forward, or certainly at least produce to the levels that they produced in the second half of last season, I think the Phillies, they're not going to come out and say it, but I do think that they believe that if that happens, this can be not only a 500 team, but a team that can actually maybe surprise some people now with Santana and maybe create a little bit of excitement in September in Philadelphia, maybe challenge even for a second wild card spot. Again, but that's only if all those players take just a small step forward in 2018.
Well, let's hope they get their wish. Absolutely, for sure. Todd, thank you so much for joining us. This has been MLB.com Extras, Phillies edition. Happy holidays, happy new year, and we'll talk to you in 2018.